Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying with multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which sadly included pregnancy loss, last year I was finally pregnant, and now I'm finally parenting my gorgeous daughter, Ren. Hello, how are you doing? I am recording this first thing in the morning and then I am off to have my vaccination. It's been a bit of a decision about what to do, whether to have it. I know I talked in last week's episode and I shared some links in the show notes and I've shared them over on Instagram as well with places that you can gather lots of information just quickly. Pregnant Then Screwed are doing some amazing work around it, and also the RCOG. So do check those out if you are investigating, because, you know, the most important thing is to read as much and be as informed as possible and then make your decision. As it happens, this morning I walked home from nursery with another mum and she is pregnant and she's not going to have it. And it did make me kind of wobble a minute and think, should I? But do you know what? I have made my decision. I'm going with it. I respect hers completely. And it just goes to show that everyone is different. So we must, I repeat, be informed, find out as much information and make the decision that's right for us. I'm about to share this on Instagram, but I received two presents this week, not for any particular reason or anything. So I'm feeling pretty spoilt. I'm not sure, this might make you laugh when you hear what they are, which one I'm more excited about, if I'm honest. I got, can you believe this? I was in shock. A Dyson hairdryer. What? What? I'm not the kind of person who has a Dyson hairdryer. It was a most unexpected present from Bob, who decided to treat me because he got his first bit of bonus for a while. And, well, you know, who am I to say no, I suppose? He said to me that I like good quality things and I like practical. So that made sense. And I was like, yes, you know me very, very well. So I used it for the first time this morning. And I have to say, I do love it. Although, do you know what? The first person to use it was Ren last night. I was like, what? Secondly, and this is why you'll laugh, because I don't know how this would compare to a Dyson hairdryer, but in my world, it kind of does. I got an egg poacher. I know, ridiculous. Truth is, I love a poached egg, as you will know from my Instagram. And, even more so now, I fear. And when we changed our kitchen, gosh, years ago now, we got an induction hob. Honestly, for anyone new here, they're going to be like, what kind of content is this? It's so random. But anyway, I've started, so I'll finish. We got an induction hob. And so our old poacher had to go in the bin or the recycling or wherever it went. And I've just never got around to buying one since. But I used it this morning and I love it. Very, very happy. So anyway, slightly more relevant. Did you know that this week is Maternal Mental Health Week? It was created by the Perinatal Mental Health Partnership, and each and every day is dedicated to a specific topic around maternal mental health. It's so important, and actually we do touch upon it within the conversation later on in this episode. I know there's going to be a ton of content and support on Instagram, so make sure you get yourself there. And, you know, scrolling, reading, taking in is incredibly important. But honestly, if you feel in any way that you want to reach out to someone, do not hesitate, okay? There is so much support out there. I am here for you. If you want to just pop me a DM, you know, please, please do. You are not alone. And right now in particular is a really, really difficult time to be pregnant or to be a mum. You know, if you're not finding it difficult, that's okay too. You know, I don't want you to think that it should be hard. It's just that there's a lot going on in the world. And if you are finally pregnant after infertility and loss, in particular, I would say, then, you know, it's all going to be playing on your mind. If you are a mum to a newborn in particular, I think that has been such a difficult time. But you know what? Ren is almost two, and I have also found the last year or so incredibly difficult. So we are all in this together, okay? And it can be wonderful, but it can be really bloody hard too. And please, please, please know you are not alone and the support is there for you. I've popped some links in the show notes to some organisations which will either provide support or signpost you to lots of other amazing places where you will be able to access even more support. Whether you are listening to this live as soon as it goes out or later, the support is always going to be there for you. So really, I can't say it enough. Please, please know that you are not alone. If you are, like I mentioned, finally pregnant or parenting after infertility and loss and want a space with others who understand those experiences specifically, know that you are welcome to join us over in the Hangout. It's a community membership, and when you join, you have access to 3 support groups a month with expert speakers, a growing resource library, discounts and more. Remember, there's also the Finally Pregnant Yoga Sessions, which is a 4-week pregnancy yoga course, and they run every single month. You can come time and time again. It combines that sense of community and sharing with pregnancy yoga. And I know it can be hard to take that step and actually believe you're in the position to book a pregnancy yoga course. I know when I was pregnant, I waited too long because I was too scared. And I do genuinely wish I'd done it sooner, because it really gives you that precious space and that time out to be just you and bump. And it's lovely. And the feedback we're getting from the yoga sessions is just, oh, it's so, so special. So head to catstrawbridge.com to find out more. Or there's also links in the show notes too. Bit of podcast admin. As always, please subscribe to the podcast. Do rate and review it wherever you listen, assuming you can, because I know that sometimes it can only be Apple, but have a look. Go on, just have a quick look and see if you can do it and go for it. I'd really appreciate it. And then over to today's show. And I am talking to the fabulous Elle Wright, whose new book, Bump in the Road, came out last week. I was lucky enough to receive a copy a while ago, and I can confirm it is a beautifully written book where Elle shares the ups and downs of the past 6 years, including who we now know to be Olivia, her birth story, which, as you'll hear us talking about, was quite something. As many of you will know, Elle, otherwise known as Feathering the Empty Nest, is a blogger and author of the Sunday Times best-selling book, Ask Me His Name, where she shares about the loss of her son, Teddy, who died at just 3 days old in 2016. Elle has been instrumental in opening up the conversation about pregnancy and child loss, and I was honoured to be catching up with her again. I have popped a link in the show notes to our previous chat from last year when Elle was pregnant too. I truly hope that you enjoy today's chat, and yeah, see you soon. Bye-bye. Before we start, time for a quick ad break. Knowing your fertile days are so important if you are trying to get pregnant or trying to avoid it. With the Mirror Fertility Tracker, you will know your fertile window up to 6 days. It is the only tracker on the market that provides you an accurate and personalized ovulation analysis by tracking your LH and estrogen hormone levels. Find out more at mirrorcare.com. There's a link in the show notes, and get £25 off your tracker with the code FINALLYPREGNANT. Hello, Elle. Welcome back. How are you doing?
Hello. Thank you for having me back. It's an absolute privilege to be back chatting again. And yeah, I'm doing good. I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Gosh, honestly. So we were just talking before we pressed record. So the last time we spoke properly for the podcast was last May. You were about 7 months pregnant.
Yeah.
With Olivia. And yeah. Or we didn't know that, I guess.
We didn't
then.
Know it was Olivia. No, I know.
You didn't know the sex or anything?
No. And I remember us having that conversation at the time, didn't we, on the recording about, you know, my thoughts and feelings about finding out, you know, whether we were having a boy or a girl. Because it's one of those questions people ask, isn't it? When you're expecting, so do you know what you're having? And, you know, to us, and I genuinely mean this, and I meant it when I said it at the time, it had absolutely no relevance to us. The only thing that was important was having, bringing home a healthy baby. And that was so true all the way through. And yeah, she was a complete surprise. And, but it was really weird because when my consultant delivered her and she sort of lifted her up above the sort of curtain and presented her to us, if you like, and she was screaming her little lungs out, bless her. And she said, oh, you have a baby girl, you have a baby girl. And I was thinking, that must be so strange for her because she's done all of my scans since I was, you know, 8-9 weeks pregnant. And she had all my screening results because we had the Harmony test. She would have known from when I was like 10 weeks pregnant who was in there. And we didn't. And I suddenly in that moment, I kind of realised the significance of that, really. And she'd kept that secret, you know, for that entire time. And she'd seen me every sort of 2 weeks towards the end. And that must be so weird for them to know. And you don't know. And but it was wonderful. It was a wonderful moment.
It is actually quite impressive because I think if I knew, but I wanted to keep it a secret, I would have said she at some point, you know, like I think it would have slipped out.
But I think they're very well practiced, aren't they, of saying baby is doing this. But I've noticed with my consultant, that's what she'll say. She'll say, baby is very active today. Baby is on its side. Baby is this, baby is that. So I think that's how she gets around it. But it must be so difficult. And you must have to have an excellent poker face. And mine is awful.
And I'm going to ask, obviously, the important question here. Did you have a boy's name just in case?
I did, yeah. And you know what? We had a couple of boys' names and we had a couple of girls' names. And, you know, because we were 50-50. And actually, Olivia wasn't Olivia when she first popped out. There was another name, which was actually one of my grandmother's names. And I was pretty certain I was going to call her that with a middle name that I loved. But when we looked at her, she just wasn't that name. As much as I wanted it to suit her, she just did not. And so all for the first day or two, we were in hospital for a couple of days when we came home. They kept coming in and saying, so has she got a name yet? Has she got a name? And we were like, oh, we're unsure. We're between this and we're between that. And it wasn't until the day that we were leaving, we were like, no, she is Olivia. But yeah, we had boys' names as well. And to be honest, they were all names. Even her name was from an original list of names that I made when we were expecting Teddy, because we didn't know whether he was a boy or a girl either. So we had like a working list, if you like. And I think, I hasten to say, I think a lot of people, women have probably got these in the notes section on their phone or...
Mine's on a Trello board.
Or somewhere. Yeah, exactly. Where we think, well, we didn't use it this time, but we'll use it next time. And yeah, so her name and her middle name, in fact, were always together on a list, on the same list that Teddy's name was on. So yeah.
Wow. Gosh. Oh. And can I ask you, I know we discussed kind of the stuff we were going to talk about, but actually just us talking now, it's bringing up different questions.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, I remember when Ren was born and it took a little while for that connection to kind of happen. Yeah. And I've heard people talk about this, and this can take weeks. Like I remember hearing someone talking about it, and you know, it can take up to 16 weeks, or, you know, in their experience, it had taken that long. It's not always instant. And I wonder, perhaps because of what had happened before with Teddy, but also just generally, you know, as someone who's just brought a baby into the world, for me, it wasn't until I saw the photo on the screen that the bounty person had taken. And I saw Ren on this screen and I really saw her. And I thought, you are like, I love you instantly. I was caring for her instantly. But it took those 2 or 3 days. And then when I saw her, I thought, you are a person, but I don't know you yet.
Yeah.
And that's when it kind of clicked that it isn't necessarily instant. The love hopefully is instant, but you know, it kind of, it takes a bit of getting used to, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, the night that Olivia was born, it was obviously a a real emergency, and she wasn't born until very late in the evening. And luckily, when they called the hospital, my consultant, who was about to leave, found out it was me that was on my way in an ambulance, and apparently put her scrubs back on and came back up, which I will just never ever be able to thank her enough for, because when she walked through the door, it was like, I knew it was somebody. And I think I shouted, oh, thanks, you know, at the top of my voice, because that was just the one person that I'd been on this entire journey with. And so it was, so that to me was really important. But then when Olivia was delivered, and then obviously, you know, after a C-section, you're taken back to recovery. And we went back into the room that we'd been in, which was just down from the theatre before they'd taken us through to theatre. And by this time, it was goodness knows what time. My husband kind of crashed out on a beanbag on the floor. We were really fortunate that because of our history of Teddy stopping breathing in the night, and because what had just happened had been so traumatic, they said that he could stay with me, because otherwise I was going to be on my own in a, you know, after what had just happened and everything. And so he was kind of trying to sleep in on a giant, what looked like a giant birthing beanbag on the floor. I don't know how much sleep he actually got. I, on the other hand, stayed awake the entire night, just staring at her. And she was staring at me. And we were just like looking at it. And it was, oh, I will get emotional, because it was just like, I can't even put into words. It was like this just amazing, like, connection. And I just remember repeating to her, hello, I'm your mummy. And she was just, her little face was just looking at me, and I was like, oh my god, this is absolutely mad. And it felt like such a, like a weird dream, do you know what I mean? And there's that kind of time after they're born that you're like, oh my god, this is amazing. Obviously, I was high as a kite on drugs as well, so that probably helped. But yeah, I was just, and I did feel that instant rush of love for her, and I did feel just so, it just felt so magical. And I think, and I've said this to a few people, like, I think that moment that they sort of lifted her out and put her onto me, like, that is genuinely the closest thing to magic I think I'll ever, like, witness.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
That's so cheesy.
No, there is no cheese there. That is it is no, I totally hear that. And you know, for everything you had been through, and unfortunately, and you kind of alluded to it there, we won't go into detail because it is all in your book, like, even down to your, like, going into labor, like, it was traumatic and dramatic, wasn't it? And as you said, you were ambulanced to the hospital. It just, there's a culmination of everything that had gone before.
And I think I remember when my consultant came in and she, you know, they'd found the baby's heartbeat, and everyone in the room, you could just see the palpable relief on everyone's face. It was just like the whole room kind of could breathe again. And then, you know, my consultant comes sort of crashing through the door, and then she takes one look at me with a speculum and a midwife flanking her, and she just said, sort of looked up, came round to the side of the bed, put her hand on my shoulder and said, babies come when they come, let's get this one out now. And it was, she was so matter of fact, and she was so reassuring, as I knew she would be, even if we had made it to the planned day of delivery. And she, I remember her saying to me, do you feel you can walk yourself down the corridor to theatre? And I think that's a big thing for them, is they want you to be involved if you can, and consciously take yourself into that situation so that it takes the fear and the panic of an emergency out of the situation, if that makes sense. And so, yeah, I can remember when she came in the following morning to do kind of the debrief with us of what had happened and why she thought it had happened that way. Because I was losing a lot of blood. And even she said to me, I cannot believe, after, you know, everything that we've been through to get you to this stage, that, and all the best laid plans that we put in place, that this was how, you know, she came into the world. But she came into the world and she's here and she's safe. And you know, you must focus on that. You must hold on to that. And she was so right, because I couldn't believe at that point that she was here safely. And, you know, she's 9 months, and I still look at her and think that in many hours of the day. I just can't believe that she's just, yeah, she's amazing.
Ren is almost two and I'm still doing that. And genuinely, I think that I will do that for the rest of her life. I'm sure that all mums do.
Yeah,
but I think
yeah,
maybe definitely. We do it just that little bit more often.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's just that thing that even on the days where, you know, I've particularly in lockdown when they're before they said about support bubbles and whatnot for people with babies under one. And I even at the beginning, we weren't seeing that many people because it was still sort of all hanging over us, really, wasn't it? And we were really cautious. You know, there were days when my husband went back to work where I was on my own with her. And I personally think that had I not had the experience that I'd had to get to that point, to have her there, I probably would have found those emotions a lot harder to deal with and wouldn't have been able to look and think, you know, there was a point this time a year ago, if somebody had told me I would be in this position, I would have given them a limb. Like, do you know what I mean? Like that. And I just, yeah, I do feel so grateful.
Absolutely. And it's still hard. Like, I just want to reiterate that, like, we can be so grateful and we can just be absolutely exhausted.
And I had a really great conversation with Anna, who I know has been on the podcast with you before. Anna and I are good friends. And around that time, in kind of October time, we were out on a walk and I was saying to her, I just feel so, so grateful. But at the same time, I could just burst into tears. And I remember she said to me, Elle, it's okay. It's okay. It doesn't mean that you're not grateful that Olivia's here. And it doesn't mean that you don't love her. But it's perfectly possible to feel so much love and so much gratitude, but be completely overwhelmed at the same time. And it doesn't mean that you're not grateful and that you're just acknowledging that it's hard. And that was like the pep talk that I needed, because I was starting to feel guilty on the days that were harder. And I kept sort of saying to myself, but you're so lucky. And so, yeah, I think we absolutely have to acknowledge how hard that is. And also how hard ordinarily that first year is. But then, you know, throw a global pandemic into the mix. And I think it's tough in so many ways.
Definitely. And we will no doubt go on to talk about that. Another question has popped into my mind. We're hoping to expand our family. And when I see posts from people who are about to have a sibling and, you know, the conversation is, how can I love anyone as much as I love my firstborn? And we know how much you love Teddy. What is that like? Like, your heart just grows. That's what people say.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly it, isn't it? I think it's different. And it's just, you always make room for extra people to love. I think that's the wonderful thing about human nature and how we are wired as beings, isn't it? Is that we don't have okay, that's your capacity for love, no more. There's always more. And I think when it's your own children, it has absolutely no limits whatsoever.
I think I ask a lot of people that question because I just want to hear it, to know, because you can't imagine, I don't think, until you're there, even though, and like, so it's just so nice and reassuring to hear that over and over again. So when we talked for the last podcast, and people can go back, we won't go through everything that happened to you. People can go back and listen to that for your kind of fertility and loss history. You mentioned how you had you were ticking off the bingo card, like in that conversation. And it's just, you know, oh, you've been through so much. But one of the conversations that is often had, and we talked about it then, is about how people say that when they're pregnant, they find it really difficult. And one of the milestones, if they're pregnant after loss, one of the milestones is, you know, going past the date of the loss.
Yeah.
And obviously you lost Teddy at 4 days. And so I can only imagine that getting perhaps to that, I don't even want to call it a milestone, but I guess it's a milestone in Olivia's life. How was that? How, and bringing her home and...
Yeah, bringing her home was really emotional, because that was like something that I think we had both pictured for such a long time, the day that we actually walk up the path to our house with a baby in a carrier. And I just remember doing it. And again, it was one of those things that just felt so surreal. It didn't even feel like it was happening. I think I was just so, the oxytocin was just so free flowing. I just was on in my own little world. And actually the first day that we woke up at home with her was, in timeline equivalent, the day that Teddy would have died. And I think I'd always been very fearful about what that day might feel like. But strangely, because the scenario was so different, in as much as we'd come home the day before, we hadn't gone anywhere near a neonatal unit. She hadn't had any problems after birth, breathing or doing anything. And just being at home, I think, completely reframed that for me. And I remember it being a fleeting thought in my mind that day of, you know, this would be the equivalent day. But actually, because we were at home and it was the first day that my parents came to meet her, and it was the first day that my husband's parents came to meet her, and there was just so much excitement and so much love and such a polarizing experience to what had been our experience postpartum the previous time with Teddy, that it was a lot easier than I ever imagined it might be. And I didn't feel sad or scared on that day like I thought I might do. And I think probably over the weeks after she was born, all of that anxiety that had kind of wound up inside me like a rubber ball, like rubber elastic band being spun and spun and spun and spun for 9 months, that definitely unraveled quite quickly over those weeks. And I did have a lot of times when I felt incredibly anxious and would say borderline obsessively check she was breathing. Not just at night, in the day, if I was pushing her in her pram, I would suddenly think she's not breathing and I would have to lean forward and check her. And if she was sleeping, I would wake her up. You know, they say never wake a sleepy baby. There's me like shaking her, which sounds loopy, but it was something that I couldn't control. And it was something that, you know, I explained to the midwife and I explained to the health visitor, and they were really kind and really supportive and sort of helped me get through that.
I'm really pleased to hear you say that. And there is nothing loopy about that. I know that so many people will be doing the same. Are you okay?
Yeah, I think it's just, when I think back to those weeks, it's quite strange to think about, because kind of all of those anxieties that I felt just came, I can't even explain. They just came out like tumbling out. Because you can't hold on to that forever. You can't internalize it. And then she was here and she was so precious. And, you know, so I had so much love for her and I just wanted to keep her safe at all times. And so, yeah, that was for me how that anxiety that had lived within me during pregnancy, it just found a new home, really. And that was its new home, was me obsessively checking things like that. And there were a couple of moments where I did have a bit of a meltdown about it. And luckily, you know, Nico was there to kind of pick me up and keep me going.
And you had been, you know, we talked about this previously, under the support of perinatal mental health, hadn't
you? Yeah.
And which is brilliant. And I encourage anyone who feels the need to make sure that they speak to their midwife about speaking to, you know, a specific mental health midwife in their area if they need it.
Absolutely.
And you had had that extra care, which is brilliant. So hopefully you had been processing some of that during your pregnancy, and yet still, you know, the care afterwards, what was that like? Because, you know, one clearly needs it, you clearly needed it, you know, like, so did they support you? Did you have that support postpartum as well?
Yeah, so my midwife, actually, who I'd grown really close to during that time, because I had a case loading midwife.
Which means that you see the same one all the way through.
That's like an NHS term. A couple of my friends worked in the NHS and I remember them saying, make sure you make sure that you're looked after by a case loading midwife. Because it just means that, particularly if you've had a quite tricky journey to get to pregnancy, or it's pregnancy after loss, you don't have to go into each one of those appointments and tell your story again and again and again. And that just walking through that trauma when you're already feeling anxious ahead of an appointment where someone's got a Doppler, you know, all of those things that can be so triggering. So I was really lucky that I had my midwife, and the perinatal mental health support that I'd had all been over the phone because of COVID, apart from them being able to walk me around the unit before delivery. So we did that together the week before. And then they came to see me the days that after Olivia was born to make sure I was doing okay, particularly after her birth. And then they called me the week after. But because my actual midwife had been coming to the house doing all of our face-to-face visits, she had sort of agreed that she would carry on our care, and she would do that for longer than she would ordinarily do. So I think she probably saw us until maybe 3 to 4 weeks. She kept coming sort of every few days, which was really, really lovely. And I think it made a world of difference to me during that time, because I needed to know that Olivia was putting on weight and she was doing all the right things that she should be doing. That's such a silly thing to say, but do you know what I mean? That she was, I had so many worries about so many things, and I just needed that reassurance of somebody to say, yeah, that's fine, that's normal, that's okay. And my midwife was able to provide that. So yeah, I felt very, very lucky.
Brilliant. That is so, so good to hear. So you're bringing Olivia home to, as we've kind of touched upon, lockdown. And yeah, you are one of the lockdown mums. And I heard someone say recently how they're probably, you know, our children are going to be known as the lockdown generation, aren't
lockdown
they?
Baby.
That's it. Yeah. How has that been? Massive question there. Sorry.
Yeah,
where do we start?
It's been a blessing in many ways, and I guess a curse in others, as probably a lot of mums in my position would say. I remember saying to you when we were in lockdown and I was pregnant that it had been wonderful because I could just hide from the world at the most anxious time of my life. Obviously, then Olivia was born, and then she was born in the summer, so sort of July and August and beginning of September, we had that wonderful bit of freedom. I'll be honest, we didn't do an incredible amount during that time. We did sort of early to mid-September manage to go down to Cornwall for 2 weeks, which was incredible because for so long had I dreamed of being able to do that with a baby. And she was, you know, she was so tiny at the time, but it was lovely because my parents spent the first week with us and my husband's parents spent the second week with us. And it felt like normality, like normal life. But then obviously things started to change again, didn't they? And we sort of swiftly went in the direction of having any of those freedoms that had allowed us to do those small things taken away again. And so it was kind of when we were coming up to Christmas, when she was sort of 4.5, 5 months, and I realised that I'd never done anything normal, like just go for a coffee with a friend and a baby. I'd never been able to do that because by the time she was big enough for us to start doing stuff like that, everything was closed, you know, all of November, everything was closed. And then December, you know, we were in and out of tears, weren't we? And I remember starting to feel incredibly isolated because all of those things, and I'm sure anyone who has had a baby over the last year will say this, all those things that you imagine for yourself during that time of having a baby in the first year, you just can't do. And I started to tentatively book onto classes, hoping they would start from January when she was kind of old enough to know what was going on. So we booked onto a baby sensory class, we booked to swimming. Everything was cancelled because in January we were in full lockdown again. So yeah, it was, there were a couple of occasions when I got quite upset about it because, and it wasn't for me, I wasn't upset for me. I was upset for her that she was missing out on that interaction with other people, other babies, other, you know, human life. And then everyone says to you, oh, they don't remember, they won't remember, it doesn't matter. They won't remember. But you think, yeah, but I'll remember that, what that felt like. So lockdown parenting has just kind of been some weird roller coaster, to be honest, of feeling incredibly grateful that you get this wonderful one-on-one, undistracted time with your child, which gives you the opportunity to, I mean, in my case, it gave me the peace at home to just go, okay, well, we're going to do a routine and this is what we're going to do. And you're going to have a lunchtime nap. And you're going to, you know, say, so I thought we might as well bloody put this to good use. You know, we've got no distractions from the outside world. But then I saw a really interesting post from somebody on Instagram the other day saying, is anyone else getting used to parenting outside of lockdown? Has anyone else got a new baby who they've had in the last year and is now having to learn how to do real life and still keep all those things in place that they have been learning to do together with their baby? And she absolutely nails it in her post. And there were so many people's comments saying, yes, I genuinely don't know how to go out and do normal stuff and keep everything in place that we've been doing. So yeah, we're learning that this last couple of weeks. Last week we had like our busiest week on record. And I think by Friday we were both like, oh my God.
Pooped, totally yeah, pooped.
This is what real life feels like.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I had an experience, it must have been in the autumn, and I was in the park with some other mums and Ren, and there was like a situation with a ball and the little one sharing it. And I kind of had to give Ren not a talking to, like, you know, she's 18 months old. It's not, but, you know, a bit like, come on, you have to share. You have. And it was I actually felt really self-conscious,
yeah,
because I had to do that in front of people. And it was a whole new experience for me. And I was a bit like, how do I parent in front of other people? Like, yeah. I don't know what that looks like. And even saying that, I think, oh my God, what am I doing behind closed doors that I wouldn't do in front of people? Nothing.
But absolutely it's
just,
nothing. It's
I just so felt weird. So self-conscious. So yeah, I think that that's affecting lots of us, you know, with little ones at different ages. And I'm struggling really to get back out in the world in a way. Like, we went out for lunch last week and I think things opened up the week before.
Yeah.
I haven't got a lot else in the diary. We go to Monkey Music on a Friday. Brilliant.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're brilliant by getting out and about as much as
you
can.
I mean, I say out and about. It was my birthday last week. So we had like a couple of, I had friends that I was seeing on the Monday. I went to see a friend in her garden. And then the Tuesday, it was my sister-in-law came and we took other girls to the swings because one of my nieces is still nursery age. And then we went to the zoo on my birthday. That was what I wanted to do, was at the grand old age of 36, was take my daughter to the zoo. But I think I was more buzzing than she was. And then we went to our first class on Wednesday. And a bit like you, you know, I went into that class thinking, oh my God, there are other mums, other babies. And you're sort of shyly sort of saying, it's like dating, isn't it? It's sort of saying hello to everyone. I'm Mel, this is Olivia. Like, and I was so fearful that she was going to be scared of that environment and those other people. But she was the class clown. Honestly, she was absolutely so happy to be there. She kept squealing with delight and trying to crawl across the floor towards all the other babies to touch their faces. And yeah, it was, I needn't have worried at all. So I had all those worries. You build it up in your head, don't you? It's a lot worse than the actual. But yeah, we're trying to just do a few things. Saying that, I haven't done any things, you know, without her yet. These are still lunchtime, daytime activities. I haven't seen a friend for a drink or gone anywhere for dinner or lunch or anything exciting like that. That hopefully will come.
All to come. Definitely. You mentioned there, and actually I had thought this when you were talking earlier on about bringing Olivia home and kind of the build up to certain situations.
Yeah.
And often I think that the build-up, as you said, can be worse than actually something happening. So for anyone sitting in that build-up, I guess, please kind of hear that. But how has everything been? Like, how is it parenting Olivia?
How has it been as a general experience? I guess, you know, it's a bit of a weird one because you're a first-time mum in so many ways, but you're not a first-time mum. I find it really difficult to place what I am, like what my narrative is now. Whereas before, it was really easy for me to just be a bereaved mum who was trying to have another baby, and that was what I knew. But now I'm a mum to a small baby, but I'm not a new mum, but I kind of am a new mum because I've never done any of those things before. So it's weird. But I have to say, all of the things that I've experienced with her are kind of exactly how I imagined and how I had hoped it might be. And yeah, it's been great. I know I keep saying that and I'm making it sound like it's all wonderful, but from my perspective, I have really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed just being her mum, and it's something I think, you know, I've waited such a long time to do it, and now I get to do it. And I'm, yeah, it's obviously, as we've already touched on, it's overwhelming being a parent at time. I think particularly, you know, now she's crawling and seems to have some sort of strange magnetic force towards danger at all times, that I feel like I'm just crowd control in the house in the days, just trying to stop her from, you know, pulling Boris's water bowl over or crawling into the fireplace or whatever else is going on. But there's that kind of, you know, that kind of anxious feeling that you have all day, that you are solely responsible for somebody else's safety and welfare. And then when they go to sleep, you kind of go, oh, in the evening, it's like you breathe out and you're like, okay, I can just sit. Nobody needs to be man marked. This is like, you know, that there's that. And that's quite overwhelming, isn't it? But other than that, I've just, yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Honestly, I have.
Oh, that's amazing. It really is. Now, I'm going to ask a question now that we have talked about before.
Yeah.
That most people, this wouldn't necessarily be a thought when okay. they've got a 9-month-old baby, you know, yeah. because you are in the throes of, you know, having a 9-month-old baby and all that that entails.
Yeah.
However, coming from a fertility and loss perspective.
Yes.
Very, very often, and I'm learning more and more, and from my own experience and lots that I speak to, you know, we're already planning getting pregnant again.
Yeah.
When we're pregnant, you know, or what that yeah. might look like, or how it happens,
yeah.
or, you know, like I had a conversation with someone and they were, yeah, they were, even before they were pregnant the first time, they were kind of planning subsequent pregnancies. Where are you within that? I know that you have 14 embryos. Like we have talked about this a little yeah. bit. So I know that it's okay to ask yeah, this question. Yeah.
It's fine to ask this question. And do you know what? I think it's really, really important to have this conversation, because I think that particularly in this kind of world of trying to conceive, there's maybe a common misconception that once you have your one, your child is here, your journey of infertility isn't over. It doesn't matter how you got that baby, you've got a baby now, so you know that's great. You can't call yourself infertile anymore, no matter how much help you had to get there, because you carried a baby and you had it, or somebody else carried it for you, or you adopted them, you've got your baby. And I think that is the thing that we start to think, oh, okay, is it, am I pushing it too far? Am I being greedy, already thinking about that I might want another one? But I think for us, there is no question in my mind that we will not try for another one. I guess, you know, had Teddy been here, let's say, and then Olivia had taken another 4 years to arrive, I think I would still want to go again, because I'm one of three. My husband's one of three. It was always our ideal to have three children. I think we're probably now accepting that maybe we might have three children, including Teddy, so not three here, if that makes sense, because pregnancy is really hard, isn't it? And it is really hard on your body, and the recovery is hard, and that is harder the older you get. And I think that if we were lucky enough to be able to either conceive spontaneously again, like we ended up with Olivia, or use one of those many embryos, then that would be wonderful, is the answer to my question. But it's tricky, isn't it? Because I'm finding, even with her being, you know, so young, the few conversations that I have had with people do start to touch on that and say, you know, do you think you'll have any more? Do you think? And also I find the question, is she your first? Obviously a bit socially awkward to answer, because I then have to tell them no. And on some days that's fine, I can do that without crying, and some days I can't. And then you feel like you've ruined somebody's day. But also it's like, why do we say, is she or he your first? Like, assuming that you will go on to have more, like that's a given. If you have one, then it's a first. It's not a stopping point. It's not an only. That's a really weird question, isn't it?
It is, when you put it like that, because there's just that automatic assumption that there's going to be more.
Like there has to be more. There has to be more. It's not even like a, would there be more? It's like a, if it's your first, then you're assuming there's going to be a second, third, fourth. But, you know, the more I've thought about it lately, I'm just like, that could be really tricky for people to answer for so many reasons. But yeah, we've talked about it already, I'll be honest, you know, because 4 years in between one baby to the next was quite a long time. And obviously there was a lot of stuff that happened in that time of loss and extra fertility treatment. I really hope that it's not that complicated again. And I really hope that however it happens, it's easier and quicker and less heartbreak thrown into the mix. Because if I'm perfectly honest, I really don't want anything else to have to write about. I feel like I've had enough material. If life gives me more material, something has gone terribly wrong. Okay?
You're done. Yeah.
Over. But yeah, I think it's important to have that conversation, because I think there will be so many people listening, hopefully, who have gone through that journey. They have their baby or babies, and they are thinking, you know, should we go again? Could we go again? Could I put myself through that again? Even without fertility treatment thrown into the mix, just that knowing you're getting on back onto that merry-go-round of testing each month and trying each month, it's tough. And it's, I think you have to ask yourself, I don't know, you have done a lot of soul searching as to whether you could go again, as it were, because you have to prep yourself mentally, emotionally, physically, don't you? And I know that you're doing that at the moment.
Completely. Like, it's just, you know, and we are that bit older than you at 42, and we do only have one embryo. And you know, I can totally hear loads of people saying, oh, just stick it back. It's only one, you know, you may as well try. Why not? And all of that. But actually, very unfortunately, it becomes much more complex than that, because I'm working out, it's almost a decade since we first started trying to conceive, you know, and we have been through so much. Like, and I won't go into all of this conversation now. I did a lot of talking with Natalie in a previous episode of the podcast, who decided to stop at one and has donated her embryo. So people can go back and listen to that one. And I will talk about this more in along the way, I have no doubt, but it is much more complex because of the emotion, because of the reality, you know, being pregnant at 42, you know, that feels a bit scary if it works. And even going back in, like you say, to the clinic, to the medication, financially, can we afford it because of everything that's gone before? You know, and I hate that it comes down to money, and we're lucky that we've got this far, you know, and financially we've been able to get there and can even consider going again. But it has had a massive impact on the kind of comfort levels of our life. And rent is worth every single penny, don't get me wrong. And if we are blessed with another, they will be worth it as well. But practically speaking, we need to make these decisions, you know? Yeah. So yeah, it's a lot. And I genuinely hope that, yes, if you do decide that that's what you want, although you said that it is significantly more straightforward this time round for you. Gosh, my word.
Because I think it's like you've just touched on there, a decade almost of trying for a baby. And we were 6 years from, you know, starting to try for a baby to Olivia's arrival and losing Teddy within that time and, you know, other treatment and loss. And even those 6 years, I feel like just going through all of that trauma and that being so much more of a complex journey than I had ever considered it might be. I think when you've walked through the other side of that and you can kind of see it in your rearview mirror and you think, bloody hell, how did I walk through that? And I'm sure you do this often as well. And it's just thinking, okay, how much longer do I want this to go on for? Because for me, if that turned into another 6 years, I personally don't think I would have the... I don't think I could cope with that. And that's a really personal thing, isn't it? So I think, yeah, it's such a big decision. It's such a big, and it, like you've just said, it seeps into every corner of your life and your mind, and not just financially, just day to day. You could be having a great day and thinking about something completely different, and it will just sort of tap you on the shoulder, won't it? And say, hello. And you're like, oh God, I need to think about infertility. It's so weird.
So one of the things, actually, someone has asked me specifically to ask this question, and it is something that's come up time and time again, actually, about talking to siblings about siblings that aren't with us.
Yeah.
And so, like, I have no doubt that you have thought about this.
Yeah.
Can you, you know, not specifics, dates, times, how old she'll be, but can you just... tell us a little about your thinking around telling Olivia about Teddy.
Yeah, so it's something that my husband and I have kind of, I guess we kind of started talking about it theoretically before she was even here and before I was even pregnant again. I think it's something that's always been on our radar since he died of, well, how would we go about that and how would we include him in our family story if he's not physically here. And I think any parent who's lost a child will know that you kind of, as you muddle along, you come up with a myriad of different ways to do that, whether that be writing their name or having pictures of them around the house or celebrating certain days or doing certain things, going certain places that mean things to you. And I think because that's, you know, it will be 5 years next month since Teddy died. And I think that doing all of those things has become such a part of our life in that time that she's bound to pick it up, I guess, that, you know, that's what we do. When we go to the beach, mummy will probably go and find a stick or a bit of something and write, you know, I'll probably write his name, but I'll probably write her name as well. And she'll, you know, it's that kind of thing that if you do it naturally without, you know, sitting them down at a certain age and saying, now, let me tell you about your big brother who died. I don't think it will come to that as a conversation. I think it will be very much that because we do weave him into different things, it will just be like a given for her as she grows up and she begins to communicate with us. I'd very much like it for her to just know that those pictures that are on the wall on, you know, the landing outside her room, well, that's her big brother. And I want it to be that more natural kind of progression of just into knowing that he's a part of the family, but he's not here. Does that make sense?
Total sense. I was once told that apparently, like, a professional term, psychologically speaking, counsellor kind of talk, is a door handle moment. So it's kind of like that's when something's dropped on you, essentially.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the right term, a door handle moment. And that, by all accounts, please don't take this as read from me. I am not a professional of anything, really. but, you know, like, that can have quite a damaging impact, rather than, as you say, you know, just weaving it into
normalizing it. And that's, you know, a big part of what I have been trying to do, and countless women now on social media and through blogs and other mediums are normalizing the conversation around child loss, and not just for themselves, not just within their own families, but for society as a whole, because if we're all better at talking about it, then it just becomes a natural thing that people do and they can do. And children are incredible when it comes to talking about grief and things like that. Our nieces and nephews have been some of the most open and honest in wanting to talk about Teddy and ask questions about him. And they don't have any qualms in saying, you know, Auntie Al, do you miss Teddy? Does that make you feel sad? You know, straight out. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I do. Yeah, it does. You know, that's just, they're really matter of fact about it. And I just would like Olivia, as she sort of learns, as she's growing up, to feel that that's okay. She can ask me those questions about him as well, without it being this big, scary, unmanageable thing that hangs over us as a family. I don't ever want it to be like a dark cloud. I want it to just be something that's part of our story.
A family that I think have done this so well. And I know it's a slightly different situation because their two children were here and they lost their third child, are Ben Fogle and his wife. And yeah, the way that they talk, and I'm trying desperately to think of his name.
Willem?
Yeah. And yeah, the way that they talk about him, and it's just, it is that like normal, like quote unquote, but it's just, it's very inspiring, I feel.
Yeah,
like.
And Marina is an incredible example of normalizing difficult conversations with children and with her children in particular. I think the way that Ludo and Iona, her older children, sort of know about Willem and how he is, again, weaved into their family story. And she was, you know, I've had countless conversations with her about how she navigated that, as she was very poorly after Willem passed away. And, you know, she wasn't herself for a very long time because she was poorly. And she had to explain that to her children. And so they kind of lived through that grief and that trauma with them. And I think she has done an incredible job at normalizing those conversations with them and keeping him as a huge part of their family. And it's really, like you say, it's different because they're older and they sort of probably remember their mum being pregnant to a certain extent. I would imagine, particularly Ludo's, he's older. But when a child is, you know, their sibling is gone before they arrived, it's something maybe that is just a different way of approaching it, that you have to think, okay, how am I going to do this in a way that she just learns about him as we go, rather than it being this conversation one day that we have to sit down and have. But I think having photographs up around the house, and, you know, we mention him in everyday conversation. If we were talking about something, I could quite easily say, oh, when I was pregnant with Teddy, or I would say, oh, you know, there are photographs of me that she would maybe see, that from my brother's wedding where I was heavily pregnant. And I'm imagining that when she's a bit older, she'll say, oh, mummy, were you pregnant with me there? And I'll have to say, no, I wasn't. You know, that was your older brother. And I think that will, yeah, hopefully. I'm just, this is all sort of me being very hopeful for the future and the theoretical conversations that haven't even happened yet. But that's how I plan on doing it. And I don't think that that's the right way. I don't think it's the way that people, you know, I'm not saying that. I'm like you, I'm not a professional in any capacity. But for us, that feels like the best way for us.
Totally. And that's what we all have to do, isn't it? You know, we can listen to other people's stories. We can learn so much. We can realize that we are not on our own, but also we need to realize that every situation is different, and we're all individuals, and we will process things and move on from things and deal with things in the way that's right for us.
Yeah.
So looking ahead now to emergence, like properly, who knows, it might happen, into the world. Oh my God.
Being released back out into the wild. I
Summer
know.
2021, everyone. It's going to go off. What are you like most excited about?
Oh, I don't. That's the question, isn't it? Do you know what I'm most excited about? And this is a question in my head, actually. You know, on the 21st of June, that magical date, the 21st of June, where part of the subtext of that date in June says, all social distancing measures are no longer required. Is that the government's way of just saying hugging is back on? Is that what they're saying?
Is it a hug day?
Because nobody has officially said that, have they? They've just said all social distancing measures. Is that hugs are back, everyone? So if that is the case, I'm really looking forward to hugging everyone because it gives me quite a lot of trouble to see my friends and just be like, hi, really wooden, how are you? And not just, I have to sort of hold myself back from lunging at them almost and just giving them a great big hug. And yeah, that's been the toughest thing for me. So I'm really looking forward to hugs being back on the agenda. So if you do know me, or quite frankly, if you don't know me, watch out, is what I'm saying.
There is a hug coming your way.
Yeah, why not? It's
so hard, isn't it? I'm seeing someone on Saturday who I haven't seen for ages. And I know, like, and I've been through this, like all of us. Yeah, it's so hard not to just, I am a hugger. I'm the same. I am a hugger. I just want to sweep you up in my arms.
Yeah.
And yeah, that has been incredibly hard.
It goes against every force of your human nature, doesn't it, not to do it? And I'm like, oh, I have to hold myself back. So, and I actually found that one of the most difficult things of being pregnant during the pandemic was that the midwives, when I was getting really upset in some of my appointments, particularly towards the end because I was really anxious, was that they weren't allowed to physically comfort you in that, with that contact. So you'd be sat in your, you know, in your appointment, they'd have a mask on, you'd have a mask on, and other than to touch you with the Doppler to check the heartbeat, if you burst out crying, they were not allowed to hug you. And that goes against everything that a midwife is, you know, it must be so tough for them. And I remember my midwife saying that to me. She was like, it breaks me not to be able to comfort you. So yeah, I think we should all celebrate when hugs are back on. Let's hope they are though. Let's hope that they don't put in some like other rule, like a new rule.
Yeah.
They love throwing in new rules, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. When you said about the tears, I had actually totally removed that from my brain and it just all came back that we were suddenly...
raise it from your memory, tears.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to kind of just continuing, starting to do a few more of those normal things, parenting things with Olivia, you know, just, I don't know, going on a picnic and not being fearful that we have to book 3 months in advance, or you know, whatever else seems to be the scramble at the moment, or maybe going down to Cornwall again and enjoying it and going out for some lunches. I'm just looking forward. I sound so boring, I sound like such a boring bastard, but I genuinely am, probably like most of us, just looking forward to the most straightforward, mundane things. I don't even want to go wild anymore. I will not be, you know, hitting up Wireless Festival anytime soon. I am genuinely just here to have a coffee with a friend and a bit of normal human interaction, and that will just be lovely.
Yes.
Are you feeling the same? Have you got plans?
No plans whatsoever. We were supposed to be going to a wedding in Ireland, which has been cancelled, which is annoying. Although I think they're getting married in August, but quietly. And apparently an email popped in that there is a hen do on the 10th of July. So I might have that to look forward to. But yeah, no, not going crazy. Just waiting to see, really. I think also, and it's so reminiscent, and I know that there were a lot of parallels drawn between infertility and lockdown when it was actually happening.
Yeah.
But it's almost like we don't want to get ahead of ourselves yet. You know, we're kind of just waiting to see what happens, taking it all in our stride.
I think that's it, isn't it? I think I've been kind of looking ahead at these dates and just not really pinning my hopes on too much or thinking too much into it. Because I guess as human beings, we're so habitual, aren't we? We get used to doing something one way. And unfortunately, that way for the past year plus now has been not doing much and changing the way that we work and changing the way that we communicate with people and all of those things. And I think a lot of us have probably got so used to that to that way, that it's going to take some time, isn't it, to get back to any recognition of normality, inverted commas. I don't really know what even is normal. Like, I'm a bit like you. I haven't really been sort of thinking too far. I almost feel like I can't think far ahead anymore. It's like I've lost the ability to plan, which is weird.
Yeah. And you know what I've just thought as well? Sorry. And just to be... is that I'm going to go out of lockdown, but into fertility treatment. So a situation where you don't really want to book anything anyway. What am I doing? What have I done? This is useless. I have timed this terribly.
You're surfing straight back into that. Oh no, we can't go to that because I'm going to be doing injections. We can't say yes to that because I might be pregnant and I'll be hiding it. Like all of that thing where I'll be in a 2-week wait. Don't want to do that. Like, do you know, you just cross everything out, don't you? Like, nah, can't do it.
Oh dear. I'll tell you what, I'm going to do a cheesy thing. What isn't a massive error is buying your book, which I was just about to hold up in a TV way, even though no one can see us.
She's holding the book. Audio description, Kat is holding the book.
Which is like an absolute pleasure and a joy to read. It is heartbreaking. It is inspiring and uplifting the whole way through. I can hear you talk and the humor that you bring with the most traumatic and, as I said, like heartbreaking situations it's amazing. I don't quite know how you do it, and you are a very, very special individual. You really are. At the end with your birth, I was totally, like I said, holding my breath, like just like, oh my goodness, could this, you know, why? But fortunately, we all know that your beautiful girl is home with you, Teddy's little sister. And yeah, just go and buy the book because it is beautiful. Thank you so much, Elle, for joining
me. Thank you, Kat. That's really kind of you to say. Can I just say what you've just said there? It's really, really sweet of you to say thank you so much. It does really mean a lot. And yeah, hopefully all I want the book to do is help a few people feel a bit less alone on what can be a really shitty path to tread along. And it can feel so lonely. And genuinely, I think, you know, the work that you do and Alice does and all the girls online now who are building these communities is just so great. And it was so helpful to me when I was going through all that. And I think anything, whether it be a podcast, a book, any kind of tool that can hold your hand along that journey and just make you go, it's all right. You're not the only one, and you're not the only one who feels like that, and you're not the only one who's ever going to feel like that. And that's what I want A Bump in the Road to be, for people to just, yeah, help them along something that's tough and none of us should have to face, and least of all face it alone.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Elle.
Thank you.
Look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.